Welcome to the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy, and we are here. The offseason has started, and we are rolling with offseason content. We got a couple big news bites that we're going to take today. The first is that you might have heard last week, UCLA and USC announced they were leaving the Pac-12 to join the Big Ten. So we're going to dive into what that means from a baseball perspective, and then we are going to run through as much of the coaching changes as we can to this point. There have been 37 jobs that have come open among head coaches in Division I college baseball here so far this year. Most of them are filled, not quite all of them, but we're gonna run through the highlights of that. The kind of strange thing about, it's not unique to baseball, this happens in basketball and several other college sports as well, but the postseason and the hiring cycle, they completely overlap basically. And so we were very focused on the actual baseball that was being played and not so focused on the job changes. We might have very casually mentioned here or there that this coach got fired or that coach left for that job, but we didn't really get to dive into that. So that's what we want to do here today, talk about some of the biggest jobs that changed hands so far this summer. And again, there's still some jobs open, and that probably would be true no matter when we did this, but we wanted to get this in now because before long we'll be talking about the draft. So, you know, we'll if Notre Dame hires a coach in 2 weeks, maybe we'll talk about it then or whatever. But for now, we're going to focus on the jobs that we can focus on and the latest round of conference realignment. So we'll get to all of that here today on the Baseball America College Podcast. Hopefully everyone has enjoyed the start of their off season, the 4th of July weekend and the rest of that. And Joe, I'm sure that you did.
Yeah, it was good. It was good to have, felt like just a little sliver of time, even though I spent part of 4th of July weekend out at Durham Bulls Athletic Park and at the Team USA complex watching the collegiate national team. You know, that's obviously a little bit of a more relaxed atmosphere, you know, especially coming off of being in Omaha. So it has been nice to have a little bit of decompressed time, and that kind of continues as the summer goes on. Like, there's still obviously plenty of stuff we're working on in the background, but it's a little less than it is during the postseason, which is the heaviest time of year. So that was kind of nice. I did not engage in any fireworks, so I have all my fingers. I don't know if you've seen that video going around this morning as we're recording from like a, and I shouldn't laugh because like there are real, like fireworks are just inherently dangerous. And I grew up in Texas where you can buy, you know, like basically like weapons grade fireworks at the stand on the side of the road. And not understanding how dangerous they were as I like haphazardly lit them in my driveway as a 10-year-old or whatever, but there is a danger there. But there's this, the viral video, I don't know if you've seen, of somebody having a mishap at a family gathering with a lit firework, and basically it goes off in such a way that it ignites all of their fireworks they haven't lit yet, which are sitting like underneath the bumper of a car. So they're all exploding underneath the side of a car. So it appears that there wasn't anything super tragic happening there, but it is a nice reminder that the July 4th is one of our more dangerous holidays.
Are you a hot dogs or a hamburgers person on July 4th?
You know, I guess I don't really have a huge preference there. I mean, just in my life, I prefer burgers over hot dogs. But I think that has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, you go to a restaurant, right? And
right, you're not ordering a hot dog at a restaurant.
Right, you're not getting hot dogs in the menu. Yeah, so like, I guess for the novelty, like, I guess I'd go hot dog. It feels more closely, so though I prefer a burger and I'm not turning down a burger, I guess for the holiday, I'll go hot dog just because it is a, thanks to Joey Chestnut and Kobayashi through the years, the link between July 4th and hot dogs has never been stronger.
It's also infinitely easier to cook a hot dog than a hamburger. Like if you're having people over, yeah, or just a casual grill out situation, like, I mean, you can sit there and make a really nice burger. But like, if you're just trying to, like, if you have like half a dozen people over and you're trying to make burgers, like, first of all, people want them cooked differently, and it's just way more of a production. So I appreciate the ease of the hot dog. I mean, I like hot dogs generally, but I appreciate the ease in that setting.
Yeah, you're more heating hot dogs, whereas you're actually, yes, having to cook burgers to temperature and manage not getting them charred. And yeah, you're right. There is a simplicity to the hot dog for sure. If I was running my own July 4th get together, it would be hot dog heavy. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I say that I like the ease as if I was the one at the get together that was cooking the hot dogs. Like, I was not. I made the pasta salad. But anyway, 4th of July, we enjoyed it. Hopefully you did as well. Right before the holiday weekend happened, and because the 4th was on a Monday, it was a nice long weekend for everyone. College sports decided that they were not going to take a holiday weekend, or at least not in the relaxed holiday weekend traditional sense, because on June 30th, and it happened on June 30th for a reason, or the first, whatever day it was, USC and UCLA comes out that they are in discussions with the Big Ten to leave the Pac-12 and join the Big Ten. They both have been members of whatever the Pac-12 has been since the 20s. The conference has undergone some changes and name changes along the way, but since the 20s, they've been a part of this conference that has become the Pac-12. And now they are preparing to leave. And that broke around 1 in the afternoon, Eastern time. And by the end of the night, not even by like late evening, it was official that these schools were in the Big Ten. That was spectacularly fast. They'd clearly done a lot of work behind the scenes and kept it very quiet before it broke, which is very unlike every other round of conference realignment we've gone through. Texas and Oklahoma broke, and it was like a month before things became official last year. This was different, and it was pretty jarring to see two brands like that, two programs, two institutions leave the Pac-12 for the Big Ten, and especially so when you consider the fact that geography is a real thing, and they're now the Big Ten map looks a lot like the Major League Baseball map in the 1950s looked after the Giants and the Dodgers left for California. So that's the coming reality of the Big Ten. It'll happen in a couple of years. And we can dive into all sorts of angles on this, from a broader angle to just what it means for baseball. But Joe, what were your initial thoughts as this is all taking place?
My initial thought was, wow. That was actually it. It was just wow.
I think that's actually what you slacked me.
So I saw a tweet from John Wilner, and I try to consciously not be sits on Twitter all day guy, because that can be really easy to just like slip into that. I mean, like, scrolling on social media is very much like a thing that people, whatever the social media of choice is, and ostensibly Twitter is part of our job insofar as we have to tweet links, you know, we try to keep up with breaking news, et cetera, et cetera. But I try not to just be on there all day, so I'll close it out periodically. But anyway, so I saw John Wilner, who broke this news, who works for Bay Area News Group. He's probably the preeminent Pac-12, actually, I say confidently, the preeminent Pac-12 newsbreaker insider guy out there. When he says it, it's a thing. And so he tweets like that morning, "I think the world is about to change." And I thought, and I saw that in real time, and I thought, that's weird. Like, I thought, you know, we're living in a time when people are making like subtle or sometimes not so subtle comments about things going on in politics or whatever else. And so I thought, like, maybe it's something like that. Like, I don't know what, and it turns out, obviously, it was this. And so now, you know, I circle back, you know, hours later and was like, here we are. It's hard to like really do a lot of projecting, because like, while we can guess, we don't know with any certainty what the Big Ten is actually going to be like once USC and UCLA arrive. We can make some educated guesses, but to sit here and like really game it out is kind of a fool's errand, because we I don't think we really know. I mean, everything we thought we realignment has gotten sped up to a point where everything we kind of thought we knew about what is and isn't and how these things are going to work has largely been kind of taken away. And there are some guardrails. Yeah, we won't get to, this is not a business podcast, so I assume we won't get too deep in the weeds here, but like things like grant of rights, you know, kind of locks ACC teams theoretically into it. Although now we're, you know, teams are starting to kind of wiggle around there. But so all of the guardrails we thought were in place that would keep things from happening or keep things in place, like those have just been taken away. And what we're finding out is like schools in the name of, I mean, money, just to put it bluntly, but in the name of survival, better TV deals, more visibility, all that kind of stuff, are just going to figure out a way to do it. And they're going to make it happen. And sometimes it's easy, like USC and UCLA, the timing of such is that they're really not going to have a lot of friction in leaving the Pac-12 to go to the Big Ten. But even in cases where there is a little more friction, like the school, I'm confident at this point, the schools are just going to find a way. They're going to lawyer up and spend a little money to make a little money. And they're just going to do what it is that they will do to be best for their survival. And it's the last thing I'll say big picture before we move on is just like, I think we've all seen, I mean, you can really go back to maybe not the like 2011 realignment. I don't know if exactly 2011, but that range when, you know, you got Mizzou and A&M to the SEC, and there was the brief talk of it being a Pac-16 that involved Oklahoma State and Texas Tech and yada, 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 that whole stuff. I don't know if you could have pinpointed it then, but certainly when we started getting the dominoes after that, we've all kind of looked around and gone like, oh, so like where we're really heading here is, we've always used the term super conferences, and it's a little more nuanced than that now, I think. But we've all kind of known we've been heading this way, and just to see it like play out every couple of years in somewhat slow motion is kind of a wild thing in hindsight, because that is where we're heading and we've kind of all known it. And there's really not a lot anyone's been able to do about it, try as they might, by the way. And we're ever closer, and we don't really know when the end point is exactly. And there's a lot of guessing going on. We don't really know though, but we just know that's where it's going. And this just is what it is.
I do think the drip drip of realignment is probably not positive for anyone, that it would be better if everyone could just do everything at once. But the contracts are what they are. And so they can't, not everyone can move when they want to move. And so this is what we get instead. And we get a lot of hand-wringing now every year, every couple of years about like, what does this all mean? And like, is this good? And blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, whatever at this point, I'm past all of that. Now that's easy for me to say as somebody that isn't a fan of a smaller program that is clearly about to be left behind or whatever, but you know, I could do with like 50% less hand-wringing about college sports realignment. The conferences are what they are, and you know, whatever. That's just where I have come to over the last decade. It was very exciting a decade ago, and now it's very much just like, can we just get to where we're going, please? But I understand why it doesn't work like that. And I understand why people are fighting to preserve parts of the status quo, or as much of the status quo as they can. So we will see where this all heads in terms of the eventual, you know, potential of just there being a power two or whatever instead of a power five. For now, in the more short to medium term, what this means for UCLA and USC and the Big Ten and the Pac-12. I mean, I have seen a lot of doomsday scenarios for UCLA out of this. This is a program that we're talking about. You know, they won a national title in 2013. They've been the number one overall seed in the NCAA tournament twice since then. They've been to Omaha four times under John Savage. Like, they are a really big deal in college baseball, even if they haven't been to Omaha since they won that national title. And there's a lot of concern that now they're joining this conference in the Big Ten that is, air quotes, cold weather. I mean, like, yes, it is cold, but you know what else is cold? Pullman, Washington, and Corvallis, Oregon, and Salt Lake City. So I don't care so much about the cold weather aspect of it. I do think the travel aspect, the fact that four or five times a year, depending on how many conference games the Big Ten plays and how they set their schedule up. And, you know, that's something that I'll be very interested in moving forward, how they look to do that. When they announced this move, both UCLA and USC mentioned how the Big Ten is interested in working with them about creative travel structures or creative scheduling. And we'll see what that means for from a baseball perspective, if they can curtail some of the cross-country flights. Because right now, UCLA basically, they don't come east. Like they might go to the central time zone, maybe. Like they were in Houston this year, but even that's pretty rare. They're going to log a lot more miles. So what does that mean for recruiting? I remember when Jim Penders came on the podcast here and talked about UConn's return to the Big East, how going back to you know, conference opponents, going back to rivals that players in the Northeast really understood, like, okay, like St. John's, Georgetown, like we get that. Those are programs we're used to watching and you know, we're familiar with, versus like when UConn was in the American and they were playing Tulane and Central Florida, it just didn't have the same resonance for them. But I think that might matter a little bit. But as long as UCLA continues to be the pro development factory that it has been under John Savage, like I think that is the primary factor in recruiting. You know, we can talk about all of the other various components of it, but one of the biggest things is, can you help me develop? And as long as John Savage continues to be good at that and his staff continues to be good at that, I think UCLA will be fine. Yes, this might help some SEC schools get into the LA and other California areas, but like, look, they're already there and they already can recruit against UCLA and Pac-12 schools with their massive fan bases and stadiums and the success in the NCAA tournament. Like if that's who you are as a recruit, if that's what you care about, you're already pretty interested in playing in the SEC, and UCLA leaving the Pac-12, I don't think has hardly any effect on that. So we'll see how that plays out. I will be curious from a recruiting standpoint where it goes for UCLA. But the last thing I'll say about them is that we've seen, you know, think about what ECU is in the American, what UConn has become in the Big East almost immediately. Like they just boss those conferences right now. Nobody is there to play a reasonable foil with either program in this moment. Now, eventually maybe some school will step up and challenge ECU in the American or challenge UConn in the Big East. The Big Ten has no program that is ready to challenge UCLA today. Now, in 2 years when they enter, like we'll see where Maryland, where Michigan, where Nebraska, where Ohio State, where Indiana, where those programs are at. But today, nobody can challenge them. And that doesn't mean anything bad for UCLA. I mean, we still see East Carolina consistently host regionals. We see UConn consistently make regionals. I don't think anything really has to materially change for UCLA just because they're entering a conference that is regularly rated worse than the Pac-12 in RPI, except that maybe they need to schedule their non-conference just a little bit better than they do right now.
There's been the travel piece has been interesting to me because a lot of people have latched on, and I get it because it's like the extreme geography of it, but people have really latched on to like the Rutgers making trips to LA or vice versa. And it's like, well, let me tell you two cities I know you can get to in a direct flight. I'd be more interested in, you know, USC or UCLA having to fly to Chicago and then hopping on a bus to drive 2 hours through some of the absolute most boring terrain our country has to offer to go play at Illinois. You know, like those are the trips that I actually think, or, you know,
or Bloomington, how do you get Indiana, to state college?
Right. Exactly. Yes. Those are the ones that I think are actually more of a concern here, because those are taxing trips, because that's a long, don't get me wrong, LA to New York is a very long flight. But
and also, LA, like, you do still have to hop on a bus to get to Piscataway. Like the, sure, the LA, yes, to DC, sure, to go to College Park is like very simple. But the Rutgers trip does require a bit of a bus ride after you fly into Newark.
For sure. At least you got something to look at.
Illinois just catching strays here.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those deals where it's like, you know, having lived there, I feel like I earned the, and by the way, did not live in the Chicago part of Illinois, lived in the part of Illinois of which I am denigrating a little bit. I feel like I know of that, of which I've earned the right to speak about it, that way, that, it's just, you know, and it's a lot of people love living there, but I mean, it's just not a lot going on. Like, I don't think anybody would really argue the stretch of I-57 between Chicago and Illinois, Champaign, Illinois, not a lot going on. Regardless, I think this is a good reminder too of when we talk about the travel piece, and like, yes, they have some assurances have been given. Now, we don't know if that means scheduling wise, like we'll try to game the schedule to the point where you'll make fewer cross-country trips, or if they mean like chartering, right? That could mean either things or something in between. But regardless of what that actually looks like in practice, I think this, all of this stuff is kind of a reminder of the big picture we're looking at here. And we obviously know the big picture here because like this move would not have been made if baseball was the primary driver, or maybe it would be, but you know what I mean though? Like it is not in this case. We know that. However, you know, Martin Jarmond at UCLA has come out and kind of more or less said, like, we were looking at cutting sports if we did not make this move. Now they're probably not talking about baseball there, but UCLA is a proud athletic department that has a lot of good teams. They were probably going to have to cut a program that's won a lot of games or matches or whatever it is. So that's the big picture we're talking about. So like from their standpoint, they're looking at like, okay, yeah, you might have to make 4 or 5 flights a year that are going to be a little uncomfortable, are going to take a little while, but the alternative here was actually more costly. And that's that we were going to have dozens, if not hundreds of student athletes that could no longer compete at UCLA because we were going to have to cut sports.
Yeah. And that is, in some ways, makes them a lot like Maryland when Maryland joined the league and at the time was a geographic outlier. They were looking at a significant deficit in their athletic budget, and the Big Ten and its revenues gave them a lifeline. So that's kind of where UCLA is at. USC is in a different situation, both financially and in terms of baseball. This is a school, or this is a baseball program that has done just nothing, just absolutely historically nothing for going on 15, 20 years now in the Pac-12. And so they're dealing with all of the negatives that UCLA is right now. But like, I just almost feel like, well, okay, but nothing in the Pac-12 worked. They're on their fifth coach. They just hired Andy Stankiewicz over the weekend. They're on their fifth coach since they fired Skip Gillespie 15 years ago. And they have like one NCAA tournament to show for that. And it's not even that they're like finishing in the heart of the pack, like in the middle of the Pac-12, and they're bubble out. Like they have multiple last place finishes in the Pac-12. Like things are just not working for them in the Pac-12. And it's to the point where I look at it and I'm like, well, maybe this will be the easier runway for USC to get back just to making regionals. We can talk about like, is this good for them if they want to go back to winning championships or going to Omaha regularly later? Right now, USC is at a point where as a baseball program, they just need to consistently make regionals, and they're entering a conference where, yes, there's a lot of travel, but they will have a weather and recruiting advantage over everyone but UCLA. And maybe that's a good thing for the Trojans baseball program.
No, I'm with you generally. Like, I think this is a little bit reminiscent of when Nebraska, and that one made a lot of sense geographically. It's different in that way. But when Nebraska joined the Big Ten out of the Big 12, you know, now they also hired Darren Erstad, and that was a positive, no matter how you feel about the Erstad tenure generally, like that in the moment was a good hire, got them back on track. That was part of it too. But I also think they got back into the Big Ten, which is a conference kind of more where the baseball program was at that time, and really kind of got them back on track and got them going and got them out of a league where they were, you know, making long trips down to Texas to take on teams that by that point they were outmatched by. And so that going to the Big Ten, I think, gave them a chance to kind of catch their breath and realign, literally and figuratively, I guess. And now, you know, they're in a 2022 being a tough year notwithstanding, they're in a much better place than they were, to where even if somebody dropped into the Big 12 today, they would not be just by definition out of place. So I kind of compare it to that, where it feels like this is now, again, very different geographically, but this is an opportunity for USC to, you know, you're right, nothing in the Pac-12 has worked. Let's shake it up. Let's try something different. And like, yes, there will be some weird travel going on, but they will, just on the type of talent they've been bringing in year after year alone, like they should be able to compete at a better, at a higher level just right away in the Big Ten. And will that equal regional appearances? Like, we don't know, mostly because we're still talking several years away, but I certainly like their chances a little more than what they're looking at in the Pac-12 right now.
I misspoke. It's USC's fifth coach since they went to Omaha. So that includes years under Skip. But like the larger point remains, they, things have not gone well for them in the last 20 years. They have two regional appearances to show for it. Like, so they're going to try something.
Dan Hubbs is the only,
yeah,
Dan Hubbs, the only one of those coaches, like we talked about offline, the only one to last longer than 3 years.
It's remarkable. And, you know, so now they're going to try something new, and baseball had nothing to do with the reason why they're getting to try something new, but now they get to try something new. From a Big Ten standpoint, look, you just added one of the better programs in the country and also a program that has the most national championships in the country. Hopefully this could mean something positive for baseball in the Big Ten, but if it's going to mean something positive for baseball in the Big Ten, the conference is going to have to kind of change the way it views baseball. And look, maybe by adding LA schools, it will help them do that. But I don't think you can expect, just because this happened, that all of a sudden the Big Ten is going to sit here and be like, well, now we are all in on baseball. What I would hope that happens is that there's an expectation that within the next few years, as the Big Ten gets into a new TV deal, the conference is going to be distributing more than $100 million per year per school. The conference has always been pretty rich, and they have done a good job over the last decade plus at investing in infrastructure. There have been a lot of ballparks built in the Big Ten. You look at Indiana, Purdue, several other places have had real renovations. Minnesota had a pretty significant renovation. There's been a lot of infrastructure investment. Now is the time to make the people investment, to invest in coaches. There are good coaches in the Big Ten. You know, you just this year had Eric Backich leave for Clemson. A couple of years ago, you had John Scheff leave Maryland for Virginia Tech. This kind of thing happens in the Big Ten. Chris Lemonis left Indiana for Mississippi State. If you can get the investment right so that they don't feel like they're having to make the move for money reasons, you know, maybe some of those coaches leave anyway. But if you can invest in them, invest in their staffs, and, you know, provide the student athletes with what they need, you know, give the players, you know, whatever monetary compensation is legal at the time, that is where the Big Ten now needs to move with this, because, you know, you have a chance to be a much better baseball league with USC and UCLA in the mix than you do without them. But just adding LA schools and adding an LA recruiting base is not going to do it on its own. You also have to make the necessary investment. And there are a lot of sports in the Big Ten that need investment, right? Like, everyone needs this money, or thinks they need, they will be able to use whatever money you are providing with them. They all have wish lists, but if you want to be good at baseball, you have to invest in baseball. And the Big Ten scene, if you invest in the facilities, they've seen improvement from that. Well, now it's time for the next level investment from the conference standpoint and also from the school standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just briefly on that. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I still do a decent amount from having lived in the Midwest, as I alluded to. Like, I still do a decent amount of like radio and stuff in the Midwest, and I get asked quite a bit actually about, okay, we like know that the Big Ten has reached this platform baseball wise. It's better than it was. You know, now we're looking at more like 15 years ago. No, I guess still 10 years ago, because that predates Indiana being in Omaha. So in the last 10 years, Big Ten baseball has elevated. But like, what's next? And that's kind of the answer I give, is that, okay, you invested like crazy in infrastructure. Like you alluded to it, it's new stadiums. It's, you know, Illinois is just now breaking ground on a practice facility. Northwestern has a rebuilt facility. You know, Rutgers obviously doesn't have the actual playing facility, but they have a good practice facility. So you've done all of this stuff, and I don't want to say they just rested on their laurels, but it kind of felt like they're at that point, it kind of stopped. And you're looking at now, you know, Eric Backich obviously leaves the conference. Like, Rob Vaughn's name was out there for openings this offseason. Like, I don't think,
but he did sign the extension. So that was,
he did sign an extension for sure. But the Big Ten just at a point where like there is no job there that is so good right now that other conferences coming for your coaches is going to make you feel like those coaches are safe there. Outside of the guys who are super tenured, like I don't think John Anderson is leaving for an SEC job anytime soon. But so there, it is kind of time for the Big Ten to redouble its efforts in some ways, it feels like. And some of that is just prisoner of the moment stuff, because 2022, outside of Maryland having the season it had, a regular season it had, outside of that, it was just kind of like a meh season in the Big Ten. And so some of that is prisoner of the moment, I think, me feeding off of that. But I do think it is kind of time for the league to redouble its efforts a little bit and find other ways to invest. Maybe this is a little bit of a catalyst and an opportunity to kind of be ready to hit the ground running once they enter the conference. And you kind of laid out the ways in which they could do that.
From a Pac-12 perspective, this is obviously causing a lot of existential questions at a conference level. And so I don't want to dive into this too much, because we'll just have to wait and see whether the Pac-12 is able to survive and what it looks like if they do survive. But I will say this, that if what the Pac-12 does is either find a way to stand pat with 10 teams, or, you know, largely what the Big 12 did a year ago, just find a way to keep everyone together, whether that means expansion or not. The Pac-10, as it stands today, just subtracting UCLA and USC, it's still a really good baseball league. You've got Stanford, which just was in Omaha. You've got Arizona, which was in Omaha a year ago. You've got Oregon State, which hosted a super regional this year. And, you know, we know what Oregon State is, 3 national titles this century. You know, Washington has been to Omaha within the last 5 or 6 years. Oregon hosted a regional a year ago. We know what the ceiling there looks like generally. Arizona State has plenty of reasons to believe why it won't be down forever, or at least that there will be a rebound there sooner or later. That is a good conference. That's still better than what the Big Ten is today. I mean, you're still one of the major leagues. The challenge, of course, is going to be, well, okay, but nobody really cares about what it means for baseball. It's about what it means for revenues and what this means for football and all the rest of it. But if this group holds together, it's still a fantastic baseball league, even without LA. It doesn't help their recruiting that they're not going to LA annually. Like that is going to hurt. But I think that's the way on the field where it hurts the most for baseball in the conference.
I don't know what the best answer is for the Pac-12 in the long term. I know the answer is not this like loose partnership idea with the ACC. Like, let me tell you what has not worked in the history of college athletics. And that's like real loose. Like, I don't mean this in the terms of,
so you mean like the alliance?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Like, I can tell you precisely what has not worked in trying to protect yourself from being poached. And that is loose partnerships. So like, get that idea straight out of here. And like, I get that what they're trying to do is entice media networks to like up the ante on the TV money. It's not actually like any sort of, it's just kind of a, I don't want to say a ploy that implies that it's like underhanded in some way, but it's like, they're trying to find ways to get more money out of TV networks, and a Pac-12 ACC title game maybe is theoretically one way to do that. But that is not the answer. I'm here to tell you, I'm not a fancy consultant who charges millions of dollars, although I can send you my Venmo if you'd like to send that to me. But that is not the answer, folks.
So we'll continue to monitor the realignment situation. There's a lot of talk about, can the Big 12 grab some of these schools? What happens to Oregon and Washington? Is the Big 10 done? Blah, blah, blah. Well, we will follow the realignment news as it continues, but we did want to touch on what this means for the Big 10 and for the Pac-12 and for UCLA and USC. We are now going to dive into the coaching changes that we had so far this season, or this off season. But we'll do that here in a second. First, check this out.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's dive into some of these coaching changes. As I mentioned before, there have been 37 head coaching jobs turnover so far this offseason. We're probably at a point where jobs aren't going to come open unless there's another situation where there's a cascading effect where if Notre Dame hires a sitting head coach, you could see that number tick up, but we are probably past the point where new vacancies are just being created for the sake of creating new vacancies. 37 overall, 10 of them within Power 5 leagues, 2 more in the American, 2 more in the Big West. Those are kind of the major conferences. I don't know how we want to define major conferences in this world of realignment. I don't even know who's in the American anymore, Joe. But it was a busy summer. Ultimately, there are zero job changes in the SEC. That is significant. But you still saw Florida State, Clemson, USC is, I guess, a big brand still. Still some big programs turning over. But it was a lot of movement really at lower levels, some movement, with some major jobs, but not maybe some of the biggest jobs opening that at points during the season, it looked like, there might be, you saw some people projecting 3-4 SEC jobs might open and in the end, zero.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that in the moment that no SEC openings. I guess I just hadn't taken the full accounting of it. But yeah, I mean, when you talk about some of the decisions that were made, late in the regular season, Missouri decides to run it back with Steve Beazer. Brad Bohannon, Alabama coming back. You know, those in how where those guys were. I don't know. I can't say for certain. But those were names that got tossed around as, hey, depending on how the season goes, like you could see that happening. And those guys get another year, and obviously Mike Bianco winning a national title, like that takes him, that certainly takes him off the hot seat. So, you add all that together and you get what you get in the SEC. And,
I will say about the SEC before we move on here, and Millie has thoughts about the SEC.
Yeah, Millie can maybe go first if she
is that, the SEC is a place where people are always talking about all sorts of jobs. Like you mentioned Brad Bohannon, a coach who I don't believe at any point was in trouble this year. But because people see the way SEC jobs operate in other sports, they assume that because the SEC really cares about baseball, that they operate in baseball in the same way. And like, look, they do pull the trigger relatively quickly there. But it's also like, even at most SEC schools, like you're operating barely in the black or still not quite in the black. So if you have to pay a buyout for any of these schools, short of like a very few, it's just a real prohibitive thing. And so you saw Nick Mangione's name get thrown around. You saw some people talked about Alabama, Auburn, Ole Miss at various times this year. Well, the thing is with a lot of these, it was just like, well, that's almost certainly not going to happen because of the contract situation. That is ultimately what maybe saves some of those guys or not, I don't know, but it's a very real deal, even at the SEC level, that paying a buyout is not in baseball. It's not like paying a buyout in football or basketball.
Well, I was also heartened, by some of those decisions, because I get, and I understand it's the business. So I'm just like, I almost used a phrase that's kind of vulgar. So I'll try to find a different phrase, screaming into the void, about, So I know I'm screaming to the void about this kind of thing, but I get eternally frustrated by the fact that, you know, you've got programs that don't really want to commit. And in the SEC, being fully committed means something different than anywhere else, right? But you've got programs all over the country that are kind of like half in, half out, and they aren't winning enough. So they fire coach and they bring in a new coach, and like magically they're more committed. Like the coach starts getting things, right? Like facility improvements or increased salary pool for assistants and yada, 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 where it's like, well, you know, the last guy might've been able to do some things if you'd have been willing to do that. Right. And so you look at places like Missouri and Alabama, and I think people might be surprised to talk about Alabama in this way, but because they are what they are in football, I think that some assumptions get made. But in terms of baseball, like they are pretty far down in terms of you know, what they are commitment, at least with what we can see publicly, right? Salaries, things of that nature. And then Mizzou, we know what Mizzou is or isn't within the SEC. And so the idea that schools like that, which don't have, I mean, Alabama has some history, but we're talking 20 plus years ago now. You know, I think the further we get, the more we realize like Mitch Gaspar did a really good job there for a while. We look at what those programs are, the idea that they were just going to cycle through and find some other guy with the current level of investment, that's in italics as I speak, and have the results be wildly different, I think is just kind of foolhardy. So like, I always feel like now whether these guys get more investment remains to be seen, but just the idea of changing a coach for the sake of changing a coach without changing any of the other factors around them, I think in some cases it's kind of lunacy. Are there some cases where that's the right move? Absolutely. Sure. But there are some cases, I think Mizzou in particular, right? Where it's like, we know what the struggle is there. The idea that you just are going to go find somebody and like, is there a guy out there that could probably pull it off? Sure. But you're really looking for a needle in a haystack there. So not making a move there, I was a little bit heartened by just the idea of like, we're not just going to make a change to make a change and send the next guy into the breach to try to pull off something that's ultimately just going to be extremely difficult without some additional assistance.
Now, all of that said, it is very rare that the SEC doesn't have coaching changes. It's a league where either you win or you get out pretty generally. So I would expect that any of these, you just can't expect multiple years in a row of this. So I don't think this is the signaling of anything particularly new in terms of trends. I just think this is a year where things hit a certain way. And we got to where we got in the SEC where there are no new coaches going into next year. It happens every once in a while. This happens to be one of those years. The same could definitely not be said for the ACC, which is pretty traditionally the second best baseball league in the country. In the SEC, the two biggest changes happened, or all the changes are relatively connected. Clemson fired Monty Lee, Florida State fired Mike Martin Jr., and then hired Link Jarrett away from Notre Dame, creating a third ACC opening. The Notre Dame opening remains an opening. Clemson hired Eric Backich. Eric Backich and Link Jarrett, you know, we don't grade hires for any number of reasons, but if we did, I have to imagine, Joe, that those two would be the highest graded hires of this year. It's hard to imagine anyone else. You know, Eric Backich has played for a national championship at Michigan. His track record at Maryland and at Michigan is of winning a lot at programs that don't have as many resources or advantages as Clemson. He's going to a place where he is familiar. He was a volunteer assistant under Jack Leggett there for a season. He helped Tim Corbin build Vanderbilt. That's why he left Clemson. He left with Corbin to go to Vanderbilt as his top assistant. So his track record is pretty sterling. And then Link Jarrett also has won a lot as a head coach, as an assistant coach, just took Notre Dame to the top of the ACC almost instantly upon arrival in South Bend. He only lasts 3 years in South Bend, takes Notre Dame to an ACC title in 2021 and within a game of Omaha, and then to Omaha in 2022. And then goes back to his alma mater, a place where he also spent a year on the coaching staff. before moving on in his career. So those two guys, I mean, it's hard to imagine two searches landing on better guys than what Clemson and Florida State were able to.
I think that's right. I mean, Link Jarrett going back to Florida State is the slam dunk of slam dunks, not in terms of the results, because like Teddy said, we don't grade these hires because you just never know. But in terms of pegging one person in a place, that is as close a match as you could get there, obviously. It was to the point where like we all knew kind of what the situation was when, Florida State moved on from Mike Martin Jr. We were like, okay, well, something is probably going to have to change for this not to be Link Jarrett's job, right? And so that just seems like a real plug and play situation. To the point where Notre Dame can probably only be so upset, because it was just like, well, we always knew this on the table. And like, this really goes back to, especially once it was clear that something was happening at Notre Dame, it just kind of was like something that you thought of like, well, unless Mike Martin Jr. goes on a run like his father, where he's here 40 years, which of course is extremely unlikely considering he's getting a little bit of a later start in his career than his father did. But unless that kind of thing happens, Link Jarrett is going to be a guy who comes up whenever this job comes open again. Right. And so it ends up being earlier than we thought. And so here he is. And then Backich. Yeah. I mean, I'm with you there. I mean, I think we would, if we had access, and we don't, but if we had access to know for certain all of the opportunities that have at least been run by his agent, or have been talked about or what have you, like if we were able to see that list, I think that would be enough to tell us that Clemson made a smart hire in bringing him in, because he's had plenty of opportunities to leave Michigan for other things and has chosen to stay at Michigan because he was comfortable, but also because he was waiting for something that he felt was right. And so the idea that he's turned down the places that he's more than likely turned down to end up in Clemson, I think tells you what you need to know about how he feels about the potential there and about, what Clemson was able to provide him for this job. It would lead you to feel pretty good about the way things should go here in Clemson in the next several years.
Clemson and Florida State it's really hard to order ACC jobs. Those are two of the top ones though. And, look, Florida State was only, Mike Martin Jr. only had 3 years at Florida State and one of them was 2020. So I don't want to say like, well, they haven't won the ACC in however long, like whatever. Things didn't work for Monty Lee at Clemson. It's been a long time since Clemson has operated at the level that they think they need to be operating at. Their athletic director, after firing Monty Lee when he met with the media, said that he considers it to be a top 15 to 20 job nationally. And so that, to me, says like, all right, so they basically fired Jack Leggett 7 years ago, 8 years ago, however long ago that was, because he wasn't getting to Omaha anymore, wasn't winning regionals anymore. And then Monty Lee also didn't do that and now missed the tournament in back-to-back years. So first of all, Backich needs to correct that, but they are still believing that this is a team that should be in contention to go to the College World Series every year. You talked about, are you going to give them more things? And, Clemson, I think, is committed to Backich at a level that maybe is going to push them further towards that, because that's what they needed to do to hire him away from Michigan. And, so I'll be interested to see where these two programs go under Backich and Jarrett, not just from a like, well, of course you are, Teddy, they're Clemson and Florida State, but what does that mean for the rest of the ACC? What does that mean for the power structure? Because you now have these two guys taking over two of the more established programs, ready to challenge Miami, North Carolina, whoever else is Virginia now, Louisville at the upper echelon of the ACC. All right, let's go to the Big 12. There were two changes there. Baylor hired Mitch Thompson, former Baylor assistant, but he was hired away from McLennan Junior College, where he won the national title in 2021. A bit of an unusual hire. Nobody had been hired from a junior college to the Big 12 and directly in more than 30 years. And look, he's a little different in that he spent a lot of time at Baylor under Steve Smith. So it's not like you're hiring a younger junior college coach that doesn't know what he's doing in the Big 12, but still a bit of an unusual place to look if you're Baylor. And then Kansas hires Dan Fitzgerald, who spent several years as an assistant at Dallas Baptist and the last season as an assistant at LSU. He is a first-time head coach, as is Mitch Thompson. So Baylor and Kansas in the new Big 12, Joe, I mean, once Oklahoma and Texas leave in a few years, Tech, TCU, Oklahoma State, we figure that those are going to be the programs at the top of the Big 12. But there should be room beyond them. And maybe Mitch Thompson and Dan Fitzgerald can help the Jayhawks and the Bears get into newer, better positioning in the new look Big 12.
Yeah, I think that's what this is about. And they're on two different planes, right? Where Baylor is certainly, the floor is higher there. The bottom kind of fell out this past season, but relative to expectation, but they certainly have a higher floor than what KU does. But KU also trying to do kind of a similar thing where it's like, let's raise the floor. Let's get up and get somebody again. It's been a while since they've been to the postseason. That, you know, when things were going well under Rich Price, they were that kind of quintessential program that would basically do a full tear down and rebuild every 3 or 4 years, where they'd recruit a group together, and that group would get older together. And by the time they were juniors and seniors, they would pop up and get to a regional, and they basically have to start over again. You know, they missed a couple cycles recently. So for KU, I think it's like, can we kickstart those cycles a little faster? And I think, you know, Dan Fitzgerald is a really interesting name there. I did radio in Kansas a couple of weeks ago, and they asked me about him. And I said, look, that job is tough enough that I think there are a lot of really talented coaches that would not work out there. And I'm doing air quotes, by traditional measures. However, he's a pretty good bet though. You look at the Dallas Baptist teams that he helped recruit. That is, I think that's the most, I think it goes without saying, most intriguing thing on his resume relative to this job is you look at the Dallas Baptist rosters that he helped put together. And I think it's easy to assume, well, yeah, they're in Texas and they're in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Like, they're just going to recruit a bunch of DFW kids and like, that's ready-made, let's go. It really wasn't that. I mean, they did plenty of that, sure, but it's junior college kids, it's high school kids, it's kids from the Midwest, it's kids from the Deep South, it's kids from the West Coast. Like, he was very, very good at talent acquisition from a lot of different places. And if you're KU, you can't just like hang out in Kansas City, especially now that Dave Van Horn in Arkansas just kind of gets whoever they want in Kansas City. You really can't just hang out in Kansas City, which is a good, not great baseball hotbed in the scheme of things, and get the guys you are going to need to become a regional team. Like, you're going to have to be creative. And that's something that he did at DBU really, really well. So I'm intrigued by that, to at least get KU to a point where they're, in the worst years, they're pesky. Because right now, recently, in their worst years, they're just not competitive. So I think, you know, what they're trying to do there is get to a place where in their worst years, they're pesky. And in their best years, they're a regional team. And oh, by the way, can we also make that one out of every 3 years instead of one out of every 4 or 5 years, which is kind of what they were on before. So we'll have to, obviously, that is a long tail on that. I don't think that's an immediate thing. I mean, with the transfer portal, like, they have done some movement in the transfer portal. So, like, you know, who knows, but that's more likely a long-term thing there. Baylor is a similar hire to me in that, well, I guess it's different in this way, that the most profound thing about this hire to me is that this has kind of long been a Baylor fan fiction novel that Mitch Thompson gets this job, because when Steve Smith was let go before they hired Coach Rod, Mitch Thompson's name came up very quickly. People still have a lot of warm, fuzzy feelings about his time as a Baylor assistant, and why not? They had a lot of success. He went to Omaha as a member of that staff. Obviously the success at McLennan, including national titles, speaks for itself. And oh, by the way, he never left McLennan. For those who don't know, Baylor's campus and McLennan's campus are 7 miles away from each other. Like, he never really left. And so this is kind of, like I said, a fan fiction for Baylor fans. They've always kind of wanted this, a certain subset of them, I should say, have always kind of wanted this. And now they're going to get that opportunity. He's a little bit of a non-traditional hire. You mentioned the JUCO part. He's also, in the grand scheme of things, a little bit older than a lot of your typical coaching hires. So he is different in that way. But if you're just looking for a guy that just makes sense, like, he's your guy. But I think, to your point, these two tires are similar in that it's, hey, we're looking at a little bit of a different Big 12 here in the next few years. Like, what can we do now to start building, to put ourselves in positions to be a have rather than a have not in however the new Big 12 shakes out in 3 or 4 years?
One thing about both of these hires is that they both have pretty significant junior college ties. Like, before Fitz went to DBU, he was a junior college coach, spent a few years as a junior college head coach. Obviously, Mitch Thompson spent the last several years at McLennan. In the current environment, obviously the portal has changed the way programs are recruiting. And one of those ways, it's changed it in many ways. And one of the ways in which it's changed it is that some places are just focusing less on junior college players because, well, you can get a four-year transfer who has some experience, who's the older player, but you can just get him as a four-year transfer who can play right away as opposed to having to go through junior college. So some of those players that used to be at junior colleges are now just transferring. With the experience that Thompson and Fitz are bringing, will they dive into the junior college ranks at a higher level than other places? Just how are they going to play that? I find that to be one of the more fascinating parts of their hires, of how they intend to build their programs and all the rest of that. So that's something that we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out. But interesting hires. Just the whole Big 12 right now, as Texas and Oklahoma prepare to leave, very much in an interesting spot. So we'll see where these two guys are able to take Kansas and Baylor. All right, out west, there were two hires. Southern Cal hired Andy Stankovitz, as I mentioned, away from Grand Canyon. And Washington hired Jason Kelly, who was the pitching coach most recently at LSU, previously at Arizona State, and prior to that spent several years at Washington as the pitching coach under Lindsey Meggs, who retired following the season. Let's just address, I guess, USC, since we spent some time on them before. Joe, do you think Andy Stankiewicz is the guy to take them to any level of prominence, not all the way back to where they were in the 70s, of course, that's not coming back, but here's a guy who has a very extensive resume, was very successful as the Grand Canyon coach, guiding the Lopes from Division II to Division I, and now back-to-back NCAA tournament appearances there. Previously has a lengthy pro ball record. He played in the major leagues. He was a farm director. He did a lot of things in pro ball. Can he be the guy that solves the USC conundrum?
I certainly think he's got a good shot. I mean, it's kind of unfair to him that USC had somewhat in the baseball sense, because none of these coaching searches are as public as the football searches ultimately are, but fairly public dalliances with the likes of Andrew Checkitz and Troy Tulowitzki that amounted to nothing. Those are always tough situations because you very publicly are not known as not the first choice or even the second choice. And we have to assume was probably not the third or fourth choice. So, that's a tough situation to come into, but I think it's unfair to Andy Stankiewicz because what he did at Grand Canyon is different than what you see with a lot of mid-majors. So you compare it a little bit to Jason Gill coming from LMU, where Jason Gill was a head coach at LMU for, I think, a decade. I think it was literally just 10 seasons. And he improved that program, certainly not saying he didn't, but more or less it was kind of the same program for most of that 10 years. And it just so happened in his last year at LMU, the team popped and they win the WCC automatic bid. They play in a regional. They actually play well in that regional, get to a regional final. He ends up at USC. What Andy Stankiewicz has done at Grand Canyon is kind of continue to grow that program. Now, they've been good basically since they came up to Division I. They were, in a lot of ways, I wrote about this earlier this season in Three Strikes, they were really ready made to be successful in Division I, but they've gone from kind of being good within the whack, but not really good nationally, to okay, now we're really competing nationally. Oh, now we're getting legitimate draft prospect players like Daniel Avedia, their best pitcher, was a guy who was drafted by the Cubs. Jacob Wilson, their shortstop, who is in the portal now, but like, you know, I guess it's kind of just like an emergency option for Grand Canyon. He wants to return, but, you know, he's playing for Collegiate Team USA right now. So they have continued to, and then I think you cap it off in the 2022 season by they earn an at-large bid, which is a hard thing to do in a league like the WAC. We talked about that during the season. So this is not a case where it's a mid-major coach who's just kind of been like steadying the ship and they just happened to, you know, they had a breakout year. Like, no, this thing was continuing to grow. Year over year, they were getting better. And so USC is a different animal. We know that. But I think with what he's shown and having to take this USC job, especially speaking of the portal, like he's basically going to have a fresh roster. He's going to have to treat this a little like he treated being at Grand Canyon. It's different. They're not starting literally from scratch, but like in a lot of ways, they might as well be. They're at the bottom of the Pac-12. Most of their best players are gone off the roster. He's going to have to basically start from scratch, and he's got experience doing that. So is this a splashy hire? No. Is it a solid one that I think at a bare minimum raises the floor? Absolutely. And I do like the chances that he's able to raise the ceiling there and do something that hasn't been done at USC in a long time.
It's, it's a very difficult job, obviously, on some level. In other ways, it shouldn't be that hard, but it in some ways is very difficult. So, you know, he's got the next crack at it. I do like the resume. Everyone is saying the right things about this hire. So I will be interested to see if he is able to unlock what it takes to be successful there, where so many other guys have failed. But he has a lot of the right experience for this. He certainly built something at Grand Canyon that is not easy to do there. And now he'll be looking to do the same thing at USC. Jason Kelly, if you look at Washington's best years under Lindsey Meggs, they basically coincide with Jason Kelly's time on staff there. And I'm not suggesting that he was the sole reason why they were good there, but he knows what it takes to win at UW. He knows what it takes to recruit there. So I really like that hire. For Washington, I think he has a lot of reasons to believe that he can be successful in Seattle, which also, it's not the easiest job. I mean, there's a lot of things about Washington that make it seem like it should be better than what they've been if you look at historically what they are, but it just hasn't been that way. And some of that is certainly like climate and access to talent versus the rest of the Pac-12 and all the rest of that. But I think that he has a chance to navigate the situation there, because it is one that requires some navigation. Otherwise, Washington, I mean, there's a reason why they 2018 was their first trip to Omaha and why that they haven't been back to the NCAA tournament since then. So I look forward to seeing what he's able to do now in charge of the Huskies. And with both of these jobs, of course, the changing landscape around them is going to affect them. Obviously, USC going to the Big Ten very directly affects that job, but the uncertainty of the Pac-12 right now affects Washington. So that is something that was not true when Jason Kelly took the job. It was already true when Andy Stakowitz finalized, I guess, taking the job, but when he started talking to them about it, I doubt that was something that was on his radar at all. So just the change in realities of college sports are going to affect how their tenures go there, I am sure. All right, so the Big Ten had a few changes as well. Bill Mosiello is in at Ohio State, former TCU assistant, longtime assistant coach at many programs around the country, spent some time in pro ball, was Mike Trout's minor league manager for like 2.5 or 3.5 years, something like that. I think 2.5 years. And so he goes to Ohio State replacing Greg Beals. We've got an opening at Northwestern that was created a year ago when Spencer Allen retired They went with an interim coach for the 2022 season, and this year hired Jim Foster away from Army. Love Jim Foster, love that hire. We've had him on the podcast here. I don't know how much we're going to dive into Jim Foster to Northwestern, but if you're curious, go into the archives, find our Jim Foster interview. I always fantastic to have him on the podcast, and we did so just a little, I don't know, 8 months ago or so, sometime in the last offseason. And then Michigan, with Eric Backich going to Clemson, they hire Tracy Smith, who spent the last year out of coaching after getting fired from Arizona State a year ago after seven seasons in Phoenix. Much more successful as the Indiana head coach. He is the one that took the Hoosiers to Omaha in 2013 and had them as the number four national seed in 2014. That one, Joe, is fascinating.
Yeah, no doubt. That's the one that, not out of left field necessarily, but just kind of, it was just like a wow, you know, with what they did there. Because that is an interesting hire. And, you know, no matter what you think about what he did or didn't do at Arizona State, I think that is a little bit of a Rorschach test, his time at Arizona State, because you can look at it a few different ways. We've talked about that. You know, you could see the positives and the negatives in equal measure. But there's no denying what he did at Indiana. And so that one is really, really fascinating. I think that's a on the scale of things, a good hire for Michigan. Certainly has a high ceiling for what can be done there. Northwestern with Jim Foster, just quickly, obviously he knows how to have success when you've got a lot of limitations. It's a different set of limitations at Northwestern, obviously, but limitations nonetheless. So I think that's intriguing there. And Bill Mosiello at Ohio State, like, you know, longtime assistant, you kind of laid out his resume there. So nothing is going to happen in a college baseball program or on the field in college baseball that he's not seen before, but never been a head coach. And, you know, I do wonder if Ohio State is one of those jobs, you'd know better than I, where you kind of maybe have to be an Ohio guy to some degree. I don't know. I guess we'll find out. People, you know, obviously his resume speaks for itself. Like, he wouldn't have the stops he had if he wasn't very, very good at what he does. That part is clear. But this was one that was kind of like, just this one was a little more out of left field when, if you'd have told me at the beginning of the cycle, those two parties, Bill Mosiello and Ohio State, would pair up. So I think of these three, that is the one that I have questions about, that I'm going to be fascinated to see how it plays out.
Michigan and Ohio State both kind of zigged. Tracy Smith makes a lot of sense to talk to. That's a guy that had a ton of success in the Big Ten and took Indiana to Omaha, and they both talked to him, and Ohio State passed and Michigan did not. Or it didn't work out at Ohio State, I should say. Works out at Michigan. I'm not surprised he's back in the Midwest. I am a little surprised it's at Michigan. That's a place that you often hear, like, you want to be a Michigan man in all caps. And they've gone away from that with their baseball hires. Obviously it's less important for that than it is clearly for football or even basketball. But Tracy Smith is not a Michigan man at all. And, you know, he's an Ohio native. He coached it in Miami of Ohio, his alma mater, and then went to Indiana and then went out west. And it'll be very interesting. He is very accomplished. I think a return to the Midwest will serve him well. He will recruit very well. That is one thing that I can guarantee. We'll see if he is the guy that is able to take Michigan to the next level. Like, Eric Backich did a great job taking them to where they are today. Can now Tracy Smith advance that? We'll find out. Mosiello, it's incredible. He's coached, like, almost literally from coast to coast. Never been a head coach, as you said, now gets that opportunity. I don't know how much it matters to be an Ohioan. It's certainly something that has been prioritized at various times in Columbus. We'll see. I don't know what to think. He's never been a head coach. We just don't have a whole lot to go off on. I do know he's one of the best offensive minds in the country. That's something different. That's something he can bring to the table. And I expect Ohio State's offense will get a lot better, kind of in the immediate, even going into next season. I would expect them to hit at a different level. Just that is what he excels in more than anything. And you know, then it'll be a matter of getting the right recruits in and all the rest of it and program building and all of these things about being a head coach that, you know, we can't know until you do, but he certainly is a great offensive coach. And I expect that to translate. Okay. So that is the Power Five jobs that changed hands, Joe. There are a lot of other jobs, 27 other openings. What else intrigued you from the coaching carousel this summer?
A couple of rapid fire ones. Clay Van Hook going to UT Arlington. UT Arlington's a program that does have some potential there. They've had a lot of good players come through there. Hunter Pence, probably chief among them. Darren Thomas was well respected, but there just wasn't as much winning as you might have expected. Now they're moving back to the WAC, probably a more winnable situation for them than it was in the Sun Belt. Clay Van Hook also checks pretty much all the boxes you'd want checked. I mean, played for Augie Garrido, coached for Wayne Graham. You know, coached at a good program in McNeese, you know, now coached under Skip Johnson, Oklahoma, just came a couple games away from a national title as an assistant. Like, he really does check a lot of the boxes. You're looking at a relatively young guy. So, you know, he really does check a lot of boxes. I'll be fascinated to see what that ultimately comes of. And then the other one is FIU, you know, Rich Witten coming from VCU is just a very different coach in terms of background and what have you than Merville Melendez was. We've talked about before how it just, we thought that was going to work at FIU for Merville Melendez and it just didn't. And so we'll kind of see if maybe somebody from a little bit of a different point of view coming in and can kind of get that program going. I think we all, even knowing kind of the background stuff that makes FIU a tough job, I think we kind of understand the potential there with that program. So that's another one that fascinates me.
A couple that stand out to me, Carrick Jackson returns to coaching. He spent the last couple years, year and a half, I guess, as the president of the newly formed MLB Draft League, Summer League. He won a lot at Southern in his first stop as a head coach, and now he is going to Memphis. That'll be interesting to me. And that's a bit of a trend is too strong. I do have to total all of this up, but He got, so Carrick Jackson is Black. He got Memphis. Blake Beamer was hired at Butler. Chris Dominguez was hired at Bellarmine. Manny Roman was hired at Fairleigh Dickinson. There were several minority hires this year. I think that nets out into a more positive place for minority hires. Still none in the Power Five leagues, but Carrick Jackson in the American and Blake Beamer in the Big East, I do think is not insignificant, joining Edwin Thompson in the Big East there. So I think that's not insignificant. And I will be writing about that in the weeks to come. But I Carrick specifically to Memphis is particularly interesting. That's a place that there's a lot of things to like about that job, a lot of reasons why it might be able to move forward, especially in the new American. And I think Carrick brings a lot of energy to the Tigers. All right, that's going to do it for us today. We covered a lot of ground. Wound up being very newsy over the last couple of weeks. Not all of our off-season podcasts are quite this newsy, but this one definitely was. Glad to be able to run through all of those coaching changes. Glad to be able to dive into the realignment, but especially glad that we were able to cover the coaching changes finally. So hopefully you guys enjoyed that. If you did, remember, you can subscribe to the Baseball America College Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to the Baseball America Podcast. Hit the follow button, whatever it may be. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And all of the written work is over at baseballamerica.com. A lot to check out there, especially in advance of the draft, which is coming up here pretty quickly now. So if you're trying to read all 500 scouting reports that Carlos Collazo and the rest of the draft team have written for the top draft prospects, you probably need to get started now as that is coming sooner than you might think. During the offseason, we go once a week here on this podcast, so we will see you next week on the Baseball America College Podcast. We'll find something to talk about. I think probably draft related. Again, that's coming pretty quick here. So we appreciate you guys sticking around into the off season. And we will talk to you next time here. Thank you for listening. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll see you next week.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.